is operating without complete air superiority. For the first time since the Korean War, Iran has time and again stated that its military capabilities are merely defensive and are designed to deter foreign threats. Our correspondent Colin Campbell joins us now from Washington. Tell us more about the testimony that was made before the U.S. House Armed Services Committee by CENTCOM Commander Kenneth McKenzie. Colin?
Are created through lots of intel and research from the interactions that have happened prior. What they're looking at, in addition to the report that was released in the testimony, is Operation Praying Mantis, if we remember back in 1988, when there was an exchange between the U.S. Navy and Iran ships, where several sailors were killed in the exchange. What military commanders and leadership is looking to increase in the amount of the weaponry that could have improved from 30 years ago. And this, of course, would increase the casualties of these sailors who are involved in any conflict. The U.S. is loath to engage in conflict with Iran because they know that with the advance of technology, the use of mines, and the improvement of weaponry, such an exchange could be very deadly. And that's part of the testimony that you heard, trying to emphasize that a more diplomatic resolution would be desirable rather than something that would involve the U.S. or the Iranian military.
All right. Thanks a lot. Colin Campbell joining us from Washington. Joining us on this debate, we have former U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq and former U.S. Marine intelligence officer, Mr. Scott Ritter, who's joining us from Bethlehem, New York. Mr. Ritter, welcome to the program. What do you make of this acknowledgement?
It's a statement of reality. The fact of the matter is, what McKenzie testified to is something that the Pentagon has been saying in private to the executive branch, whether it was Donald Trump prior or Joe Biden today. If you recall when the Iranians shot down an American drone, Donald Trump was talking about striking Iran with a retaliatory strike, and the Pentagon briefed him on what the consequences of such a strike would be, saying that, look, if you want a war with Iran, we can fight and we can win a war with Iran, but it'll take us 6 to 8 months to build up the military force necessary to achieve that victory. In the meantime, Iran will be striking us regionally with everything they got, and they got a lot, and it's going to hurt, and it's going to hurt bad, not just us, but our allies in the region. Apparently that briefing was enough to get Donald Trump to say, we're not going to attack. And Joe Biden has been given the same briefing.
Now we also have expert of international relations, Mehrdad Torabi, who's joining us now from Bologna. Mr. Torabi, welcome to the program. Do you think that this statement is pointing to the waning influence of the U.S. In the region? And as we spoke to, said this shows Washington is facing limitations in the region.
I say hello to you. It's a pleasure being in your program. I think this is U.S. Central Command is absolutely right. In fact, Iran, I think, is if not the most, is one of the most capable militaries in Western Asia. But I should say military force goes beyond, really goes beyond what is usually demonstrated. I mean, contrary to strategic reasons, they do not always reveal or disclose all the power, all the means they may have in their possessions. And so I think Iran's military power is much, much more powerful than what is demonstrated, what is seen, what is perceived, and what is calculated. That's one point. I want to mention another point, and that is at the tactical level, Iran, well, we know, has a great army of modern drones. It has short and mid-range ballistic missiles, which are precise. At the strategic level, I think Iran, in fact, has entered into space and enjoys a great deal of deterrence by long-range ballistic missiles, which are precise again, all of which are developed domestically, so their technologies are unknown to others. That again creates risk and uncertainty and makes outcomes not calculable. The third point, last but not least, I want to mention, I want to talk about moral forces also, because I think they are very important in strategic studies. I think not only Iran strategically and tactically has the upper hand, but also morally has the upper hand in the region. Let me quote Professor Mersheimer. He's an international relation theorist. And we don't have anyone to quote him, but because if you look around, it's clear to all of us that the United States has been the principal source of murder and mayhem in the region. And so I think the transformation of all of those, you know, liberal ideas of founding fathers in practice into fascism, and this philosophical and moral degeneracy is the moral force behind the legitimacy of resistance. And that is very powerful. And again, it cannot be gauged or calculated or measured. If you look, for instance, to Vietnam example, if you look to Yemen example, we realize how important the moral forces are. I want to conclude just very quick. I want to say what I just said is the fact that I should say the United States does not know anything about Islamic Republic's political and military lines.
Okay, we'll get back to you, Mr. Tarbi. Let's go back to Mr. Ritter in New York. What about the timing of all this? Talks on reviving the JCPOA are ongoing at the moment. Do you think that there's any significance to the timing of all this?
Absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, I believe the significance is General McKinsey is putting a marker on the table to Congress and anybody who's listening that diplomacy better work. And anybody who thinks that we can give short shrift to diplomacy, that if the talks in Vienna fail and Iran continues to operate outside of the restrictions required by the JCPOA, that there's a military option. I think what General McKinsey is saying is there isn't a military option. Don't look to the military to solve this problem. That it won't be easy, it won't be quick, it won't be cheap, and it probably won't work. So I think that there is great significance to his testimony, and that it, in a way, he's putting pressure on the State Department and Joe Biden himself to stop playing games in Vienna and get this negotiation completed to the satisfaction of all parties, because the option beyond diplomacy, there is no military option, and I think that's what he's trying to say.
Mehrdad Torabi, the top American general, said Iran's ballistic missile force is the most formidable in the region. Talk to us about that statement. Is that why Washington wants a new deal, a renegotiated JCPOA that includes Iranian missiles?
Well, of course. It's not just Washington, it's Israel, and it's all of Iran's neighbors. The Iranian ballistic missile program has developed in ways that, I don't think military planners imagined 10, 15 years ago. And it was put on display. Iran didn't fire its most capable missiles at the Al-Asad air base back last year. It fired good missiles with precision capability, but they weren't their best missiles. They were good enough to make the demonstration that when Iran wanted to hit a building with great precision, it could do so. And that had to send a chill down any American military commander whose forces are based in the region, understanding that if this turned into a shooting war, they would pay a heavy price.
Yeah, Scott, that question was actually for Mehrdad, but I'm glad you got your thoughts in as well. Mehrdad, can you give us your thoughts on the same question?
Yes, of course. I totally agree. I think that power of this power, this is a power politics. So I don't think Iran will ever set aside its ballistic missile program because in a region that is that we see in international relation term hierarchy, real hierarchy, anarchy. It is not possible. Countries look for self-reliance and to provide security for themselves. And this is a mean for Iran to achieve that security in the international arena. It will not concluded the listed missile program of Iran will not be concluded in any deal.
Scott Ritter, during the Iraqi imposed war on Iran, as stated many times by the foreign minister, the Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, U.S. and other Western governments, they armed and they assisted Saddam Hussein with sophisticated weapons while actively preventing Iran from getting access to the most rudimentary defensive necessities. If there's a historical lesson here, it's that Iran must establish a formidable level of defensive military capabilities. Am I right?
There's no doubt about that. Let me make this point very clear. If Iran did not have the ballistic missile capability it possesses today, its nuclear facilities would have already been bombed. It's just that simple. Iran's ballistic missile capability provides a deterrence to this kind of military adventurism, whether it be by the United States, by Saudi Arabia, by Israel, or a combination of the three. The knowledge that any military action against Iran will be met with a retaliation strike by precision-guided missiles capable of striking any point within the region that an attack could be launched from is enough to give pause to the political leaders who would be making the decision to strike Iran. So without these missiles, Iran would have already been attacked. These missiles are the only thing that keeps Iran from being bombed, and Iran would be literally foolish to give them up.
And stated that its military capabilities are merely defensive and are designed to deter foreign threats with a foreign presence in the region, i.e. the United States, the massive arms sales to the likes of Saudi Arabia, and let's add Israel's destabilizing actions into the mix. Having a sufficient military capability like the one Iran has established right now is a must for Tehran.
Is that to me?
Yeah, we only have you right now.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I didn't want to talk over your guests like past. Look, the fact of the matter is Iran must have these. The best defense is a good offense. It doesn't mean that you execute the offense. It means you need to be capable of carrying out offensive actions that bring harm to the target. Now, Iran is not saying we want to aggressively, preemptively strike our neighbors. What Iran is saying is that if we are attacked, we will retaliate in kind, and it will hurt. And its ballistic missile capability is that which gives us the authority. And combine that with their drone capability. I mean, very sophisticated, very deadly. I mean, we see evidence of this, on a weekly basis, where Iranian-derived drones and missiles strike Saudi Arabian targets at will. There's nothing the Saudis can do to stop what the Houthis are using. And what Iran possesses are weapons of even greater sophistication and accuracy.
Well, you mentioned the drones, Scott. McKenzie said Iran's drones mean that the U.S. is operating without complete air superiority for the first time since the Korean War. Does the fact that Iran's military know-how is indigenous and domestically manufactured make that sound even more impressive to you?
Well, first of all, it's very impressive, the fact that Iran has done this on its own. I mean, anybody who knows anything about Iran knows that the Iranian people are some of the most educated people in the world, that their scientists are top-notch, world quality. And you would be foolish to denigrate them and think that they were incapable of doing these things. But they have weapon systems of great capability, and the fact that these were produced in Iran should give pause to any nation seeking to engage in military conflict with Iran, because the Iranians are demonstrating they are fully capable of defending themselves.
Mehdi Torabi is back with us now from Bologna. We're talking about the issue of sanctions right now, Mehdi. These advancements in the time of the toughest sanctions ever on Iran have led to Iran becoming more and more self-sufficient. Do you think that the whole maximum pressure campaign and the sanctions regime, they've not been successful with regards to the Islamic Republic?
Yes, definitely. Actually, I was talking on your question by connecting to international relations. You know, when we study international relations, we really distinguish between domestic politics and international politics on one important thing: rubber dicta. The legitimacy of the monopoly is due to force that exists in domestic politics, but does not exist in international relations. International relations is actually characterized by anarchy, as I mentioned. Iran was disillusioned by the invasion of Iraq in 1988, Patriot Defense. Iran was realized when children are suffocated in their own backyard. There's nobody else out there to get help. Even the United Nations did not condemn the use of weapons of mass destruction. So it was the trigger that started the process of looking inside for self-reliance. I think the process existed, but sanctions and U.S. interventions really strengthened Iran's determination and disillusioned Iran even more. It strengthened Iran's determination to look inside for self-reliance, for military power. And honestly, I think even sanctions I see in this remark are positive, but of course sanctions in other areas, you know, food and medicine, I see as the continuation of U.S. notorious history of international.
Scott Rear, one last question for you before we close out the show. The hawks in Washington, they've been aiming for regime change in a number of countries in the region. The list included Syria. Obviously, they failed in Syria. They had their eye on Iran as well. Do you think they'll now have to reevaluate these ambitions, given Iran's power and position that it has displayed and established in the region?
Not just Iran's power and military position. But I want to talk about
the right to dictate to other nations how they run themselves is unbelievable. But you know, the good news is that these hawks are being pushed out. That realists are starting to come into preeminence. Realists will take guidance from experts like General McKinsey, who caution against the kind of adventurism that the hawks would like to use to achieve their goals of regime change. So while I don't think you're ever going to dissuade those who are vehemently opposed to the Islamic Republic of Iran from seeking regime change in that nation, the reality is their influence is waning by the day.
All right, in 30 seconds or less, Mr. Tarabi, you can answer that question as well.
I wanted to see it from another perspective. I wanted to talk about a revolution, which was the revolution of the people, for the people. So Iran enjoys a great deal of domestic legitimacy, and it does not need to really persuade security from outside. You know, I just wanted to mention this perspective in 30 seconds.
All right, thanks a lot. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to my guests, Mr. Mehdi Torabi, expert of international relations, joining us from Bologna. Also thanks to former U.N. weapons inspector in Iraq and former U.S. Marine intelligence officer, Mr. Scott Ritter, joining us from Bethlehem, New York. Also, a special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. Bye.
Gifted and Safi, Ramadan Mubarak, Holy Records.
Ramadan Mubarak, لكل مسلم, شهر الذي فيها ينزل القرآن. Happy Ramadan to all Muslims, all the Quran believers.
insights into the Holy Quran, a special program for the holy month of Ramadan.
Welcome you, O holy man of blessings. You are seeking nearness to my Creator, for you my soul and heart has been purified.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. This is a special program for the holy month of Ramadan. In today's program, Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi explains some verses related to this blessed month. Please stay with us.
O month of mercy, you bring so much good. We pray that it never ends. Well, we know you gotta go as the seasons come and go, 'cause your time is set by Allah. Oh, Ramadan, oh, Ramadan, you're the month of the noble Quran.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. We're going to be with you in this holy month of Ramadan, talking about the different verses of the Holy Quran regarding the benefits of fasting, the most important of them, piety or taqwa. We'll be with you again after you have listened to some verses of the Holy Quran regarding fasting.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Ya ayyuhal
O you who have believed, decreed upon you is fasting as it was decreed upon those before you, that you may become righteous.
Dear listeners, we concluded that there must be a kind of relationship between this fasting that is prescribed and the revelation of holy divine books, specifically the Holy Quran. So we tried to find the answer in the benefits of fasting. We talked about physical and social aspect. And in the previous program, we started talking about the spiritual healing. As the Holy Quran states, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا كُتِبَ عَلَيْكُمُ الصِّيَامُ كَمَا كُتِبَ عَلَى الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِكُمْ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ. O you who believe, fasting is prescribed to you as it was prescribed to those before you, that you may gain self-restraint. We also concluded that since fasting is prevention and separation, and separation means detachment, fasting can be counted as the heart and reality of servitude to God. But fasting has many other spiritual benefits, such as patience, such as contentment, and many others, that unless one fasts, cannot really realize them. And even the people who are fasting, actually, their fasting are of different degrees. We have a natural diet that people at this level solely fast for medical purposes, and this is not a religious fasting. But when we get into religious fasting itself, we can see that it has different levels as well. Fasting for Muslims is mainly to refrain from what they must jurisprudentially refrain from, such as eating and drinking, such as sexual intercourse and etc. Although this is the lowest and the least level of religious fasting, once it is offered for the sake of God, the faster is religiously considered as fasting.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
شهر رمضان الذي أنزل فيه القرآن هدى للناس وبينات من الهدى والفرقان فمن شهد منكم الشهر فليصم ومن كان مريضا أو على سفر فعدة من أيام أخر يريد الله بكم اليسر ولا يريد بكم العسر ولتكملوا العدة ولتكبروا الله على ما هداكم ولعلكم تشكرون.
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it. And whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which He has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
Let me give you an example to familiarize you with this level. You can consider a Muslim girl who may fast without practicing her Islamic dress code at school, and her fasting is valid on this level. A Muslim may observe fasting and yet listens to rock and roll, and still the fasting is valid jurisprudentially speaking. But no doubt the purpose of fasting is not just to avoid food and drink, and this level of jurisprudentially valid fasting can be counted as the very lowest level of fasting. In fact, you may remember that we talked about the journey of getting close to the Almighty Allah's mercy. The wayfarer has to consider that this is only for the beginners to start their journey towards perfection, promotion. And thus, it is quoted from the Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that many people gain nothing from their fasting save hunger and thirst, although this hunger and thirst is itself an achievement, but not for the one who is going towards the path of perfection. So this level of fasting is prescribed for the beginners as a form of training to help them be acquainted in walking in this path of perfection. The least that a person is expected is to gain by the end of this holy month of Ramadan, to have gotten used to offering his morning prayers on time at least. At this level, a faster, which is in the beginning of path, has to think why he or she is told to refrain from eating and drinking, which are actually essential nutritions. Could it be that by refraining from consuming the essentials, I learn to more easily refrain from unnecessary and even harmful inputs to my body and soul? When the person successfully finishes a month of Ramadan by fasting, by refraining from soft drinks and halal food, and even finds himself or herself healthier than before, I assume it is easier by far to avoid intoxicants or haram foods. Now, the faster must be aware of such facts at the end of 1 month of Ramadan, and he or she will be ready to enter the higher levels of fasting. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to us. If you have any question or comment, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. May Allah accept your deeds in this holy month of Ramadan, and please include all Muslims in your prayers. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Please forgive us and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The World with Reporters.
A fight for survival is what kidney failure patients in Yemen face as a result of the ongoing war and siege by the Saudi-led coalition. Many dialysis centers had to stop providing services due to a lack of fuel and necessary medical equipment. Therefore, the only dialysis center in Hodeida in western Yemen struggles to cope with the large number of patients.
The center provides health services to approximately 470 patients per week. And a number is likely to increase as we receive patients from other cities, and this exceeds the capacity of our center. So we may have to decrease the number of sessions allocated to each patient. We also suffer from a shortage of medicines and medical equipment due to the continued Saudi blockade in our country.
Patients say lack of fuel worsens their suffering as they come from far areas twice a week and they can't afford the rising cost of transportation. Salim is one of them. He says he takes hours to get to the center due to the military confrontations on the main roads.
I live in an area half an hour away from the center, but the main road is closed due to the continuing military confrontations. So we have to take another road. It takes 2 hours. High fuel prices are also a major problem for us. We cannot afford the rising transportation costs.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015 to return the former president Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to power. The brutal aggression has killed over 100,000 of civilians, most of them women and children. Hundreds of kidney failure patients may lose their lives if this center stops providing its services. However, as the people here say, the international community remains silent towards their sufferings. Abdul Latif Al-Washali from Hodeida.
The weather has been improving in the EU as we edge closer to summer, but airports remain virtually empty and the bloc's tourism sector is on its knees. EU legislators say there is no coordination.
Some member states asking 7 days of quarantine, some five, some requesting a type of test, some not. Greece taking away quarantine and so on and so on and so on.
Conflicting vaccination strategies are adding to the confusion for citizens.
There are restrictions in various member states, and maybe in terms of age or gender, or some states not using AstraZeneca at all, and I fear that that may be reflected as well in the Johnson & Johnson availability.
The European Commission has set a target to see two-thirds of EU citizens vaccinated by the 1st of September, but things aren't going well.
Only 8% have both inoculations needed. What is being done to reach the 70% target in the next 4 months?
EU Health Commissioner Stella Kariakides prefers to talk about vaccines ordered rather than vaccines administered.
about 300 million doses of vaccines.
When signing new contracts with suppliers, EU lawmakers are calling for less secrecy.
Please also make sure that this time the contracts can be available. The Commission is always saying, we want it, but we can't because of the companies. Make sure you're not bound by it in the next contract.
Slow vaccination rollout means new variants might emerge. Also, millions of businesses must remain closed.
The European Trade Union Confederation warns youth unemployment in the EU is set to rise by 70%, that's 70, unless drastic measures are taken by governments and institutions.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, is painting a gloomy picture.
The near-term economic outlook remains clouded by uncertainty about the resurgence of the pandemic and the rollout of vaccination campaigns.
In the EU, people out of work for more than 12 months are classified as long-term unemployed.
A crisis this deep has generated a huge number of long-term unemployed, and that may be a problem as the economy picks up.
Lawmakers and the European Central Bank are calling on EU leaders to speed up the delivery of financial support. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The funeral of 59-year-old woman, and only her close relatives are performing the last rites. Her family says she didn't die of the coronavirus, but due to lack of space in the hospital. The second wave of COVID-19 pandemic has brought the country's healthcare on the brink of collapse as hospitals struggle with lack of resources and space. The country is battling with lack of oxygen supplies and spaces to cremate the dead ones.
We are running out of space here. We have cremated around 40 bodies since morning. This is crisis. We are tired and overwhelmed.
Just a mile away from the crematorium, a truck loaded with oxygen cylinders is preparing a delivery to some nearby hospitals with police protection as oxygen tankers and cylinders are being looted in some parts of the country. This truck loader says, we are working 24/7 to deliver as much as we can. So are the ambulance drivers.
This is war, not a pandemic. We are restless. We are running out of ambulances and oxygen supplies. But we are trying our best to save lives.
On Friday, India reported over 330,000 fresh cases of coronavirus, which is the highest daily increase the country has recorded so far. Over 2,200 deaths were also reported across the country, with the state of Maharashtra, Uttar Pradesh, New Delhi and Madhya Pradesh being the worst affected. The country has recorded 15 million cases so far and more than 184,000 deaths. Health experts say the unprecedented second wave could be blamed on a double mutant variant strains and recent religious gatherings and election campaigns, which has brought the healthcare to a breaking point.
India's coronavirus crisis is deepening further with each passing day, and the country is in a grip of a devastating second wave of the virus. Many unforeseen issues are cropping up and severely hampering the country's fight against the virus. Health experts believe the country's health system is on the verge of collapse, blaming the government's unpreparedness and failed policies for the country's failure to tackle the second wave. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
No one eats or drinks anything during the day. Restaurants and bakeries are all closed. This is not neither because of threats or the COVID-19 pandemic. What has created such an atmosphere across Afghanistan comes from a religious belief that prohibits Muslims from drinking and eating under the name of fasting. Ramadan is the name for one of the holiest Islamic months and is the ninth month in the Islamic lunar calendar. The rising of the sun marks the beginning of fasting, and Muslims are allowed to break it after sunset. Now let's see how Afghans break their fasts when the sun sets. The approval for every Muslim to break their fast is Azan-e-Maghrib, or the call for the sunset prayer. That is why almost all Muslims first do their sunset prayers before breaking their fast, which is called iftar. However, iftar time is a specific time for Afghans, as they traditionally and religiously get together at their homes or at restaurants. The gatherings are called iftari. There are special dishes and drinks in the Afghan food culture for iftari.
Iftar time is very important to our people. We prepare some special dishes and drinks for iftar, such as doogh, tea, fresh juices, and some local dishes, including bolani, sambasa, ashak, manto, qabili, and kebab.
Many here also see the fasting month of Ramadan as a time for boosting their family relations and social ties by inviting others for iftari.
We have many traditions and customs to mark the holy month of Ramadan. For instance, most of us use Ramadan as an opportunity to invite others for iftari. This is based on our religious and traditional beliefs that, of course, strengthen our social ties.
In the meantime, there are also poor people who are in urgent need of food and shelter during the holy month of Ramadan. Our religion teachings urge Muslims to support them as part of duties of a fasting Muslim. Therefore, some individuals and charity groups set up food distribution programs for poor families during the holy month. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
COVID-1 vaccine was proved safe during the first phase of the human trials. And now the second stage suggests it also provides effective immunity against the coronavirus. Produced by the headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order, COVID-1 was injected to 280 volunteers in the second clinical stage, and the results were reported to the health ministry.
We passed the first and second clinical stages, and in the next 2 days, we will report the results of the second phase to the regulatory bodies. So far, we have achieved promising results as to the efficiency of the vaccine. Once this phase is complete, we can then speak with certainty about the exact percentage of the vaccine's efficiency.
Once the second phase is over and the vaccine is proved effective against the coronavirus, the third and final stage will then be initiated, which involves giving the jabs to 20,000 volunteers. COVID-1 authorities say they have already issued the call for voluntary injections since time is running short.
Based on international standards, if a vaccine gives at least 50% immunity against the virus, it is viable and can be mass-produced. We are confident from our lab tests that Coviran is effective and can generate significant number of antibodies, so we have already issued a call for volunteers to study its efficacy on a larger statistical population.
The first phase of the clinical trial was carried out in December last year, which proved that the vaccine is safe and will not cause any side effects. Other than Coviran, Iran is working on 7 other homegrown vaccines, including Covpars, which is now undergoing the first phase of the human trials. This as the country has already started vaccination of the most vulnerable groups, mainly using Russia's Sputnik V.
Coviran is already ahead in the race compared to other Iranian local vaccines. Now as the fourth wave of the pandemic is sweeping the country, Coviran developers say they're making their utmost efforts to get their jabs to the market within the next 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Signatories of the Iran nuclear deal end their fifth session in 2 weeks amid efforts to revive the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. 2 working groups have been formed, one to draft a list of measures that need to be taken by Iran, and another to outline the sanctions that have to be removed by the U.S. Now, a third expert group will be working on the matter of sequence. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, said that would be the focus of talks when they resume next week.
Next week, it's an important question is to talk about the sequence, because we have already talked about measures, and we have now focused more on the question of sequence to make sure that the U.S., who has left the JCPOA, should come back first, should lift all its sanctions first, and then Iran would follow after the verification.
Although no direct talks have taken place between Iran and the U.S., the American delegation has been engaged in discussions with the other parties, including Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China.
The top priority remains to focus on sanction lifting. In this
this particular context, the U.S. must lift all its sanctions, may it concern Iran or any third party, in thorough, complete, and straightforward manner.
Before leaving Vienna for Tehran, Araghchi said Iran does not want to prolong the negotiations, but also needs to take the time to work on every single word that's being drafted to come up with a specific formula allowing both Iran and the U.S. to come back to full compliance. Iran says the talks are on the right track and moving forward, but as the EU coordinator put it, there's still a lot of work to be done. Homolezki, Vienna.
Tensions between the United States and Russia appear to be ratcheting up in recent weeks over a range of issues, including Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry on Tuesday accused the U.S. and NATO of engaging in what it described as provocative activities in the waters and airspace of the Black Sea. Moscow also accused Kiev of trying to destabilize the situation in the eastern Donbass region. Amid escalating tensions, Washington and its NATO allies have rallied behind Kiev. They voiced concern over Russia's troop deployment along its borders with Ukraine, claiming Russia might be planning to invade the country. But Moscow said the military buildup was in response to cold, threatening military action by NATO and nothing more. Washington-Moscow tensions heightened after the U.S. administration announced a new array of anti-Russia sanctions last Thursday. The White House claimed the sanctions were in retaliation for a range of Russia's actions, including its alleged meddling in the U.S. election, cyber espionage, and action in Ukraine. The Kremlin responded with tit-for-tat measures. But the hostile attitude of the U.S. and its allies is not limited to Russia. They have also collectively formed and launched a pressure campaign against China. Just last month, the U.S., along with the European Union, Britain, and Canada, imposed coordinated actions on Beijing under the pretext of human rights violations. The United States and China have also been embroiled in disputes over a host of issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong, and Taiwan. Beijing has time and again accused Washington of seeking to destabilize mainland China by interfering in the affairs of Hong Kong and Chinese Taipei, as well as fomenting tensions in the South China Sea. The country last week escalated its military activities after the U.S. announced it would deploy its warships to the region. The Chinese president on Tuesday also criticized the hegemonic power structures in the global governance, calling for the rejection of such moves.
The future of the world should be mastered by all countries in the world. Rules made by a single country or just a few countries cannot be forcibly applied on others. The world order cannot be led by unilateralism from some country.
The growing tension between Washington on the one side and Moscow and Beijing on the other is bringing the two countries even closer. U.S. President Joe Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington thinks is a threat to its global interests.
Northern Ireland is bracing itself for more potential trouble. Peaceful pop-up protests across the region in the coming days. An opportunity, some say, to catch police by surprise and block major roads for a time. They follow days of riots and violent clashes earlier this month that plunged the city of Belfast and parts of Northern Ireland into a crisis not seen since the dark days of the Troubles that started in the late 1960s and led to nearly three decades of bloodshed.
There will be protests around the north of Ireland, but what's worrying is that there's a lot of disinformation also. What we're seeing here is a hidden hand and trying to raise tensions between the Catholic and Protestant communities. And when we see this, these things happening, we always have to remember that when there's a void, there, extremists fill that void. And when the extremists are there to fill that void, we always see the hidden hand of British security services.
Tensions have been rising since Brexit, which many warn would threaten the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 that put an end to the Troubles. The implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol allowed the UK to leave the EU without setting up a border on the island of Ireland. Instead, the UK and EU agreed to a customs border between Britain and Northern Ireland. Now, the loyalist and unionist communities who wish to remain under British rule are demanding the protocol be scrapped.
This would seriously destabilize the peace and brought us back to somewhere that was pre-1998 and something that we as a society didn't want to see.
The riots were also fueled by the country's police chief's refusal to resign after a decision not to prosecute Sinn Féin politicians for attending a large funeral last year against COVID restrictions.
I don't see why Simon Byrne would have resigned. I think that he gave his report to those that would have made that decision within the PPS. And, you know, once he has passed that on, there's not much he can do after that. He made recommendations.
Efforts are underway for a political settlement of tensions, including a call for dialogue among all sides from the U.S. president. Still, fears of more unrest and violence are in the air. Saeed Bouriza, London.
The EU's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, updated the bloc's 27 foreign affairs ministers on the latest state of play regarding talks in Vienna to try and save the Iran nuclear deal. He told them that discussions have become less general and more focused, particularly regarding U.S. sanctions against Iran and the Islamic Republic's nuclear energy program.
I talked with Secretary of State Blinken last week when he was in Brussels. I also talked with Minister Sharif. I think that both parts are really interested in reaching an agreement.
Borrell talks about an agreement, but critics say the EU has been much too soft on the US. After all, an agreement was reached in 2015. It was endorsed by the UN. Only the US broke the terms of the accord when Donald Trump took Washington out of the deal almost 3 years ago.
With Iran, we'll see what happens.
Analysts say in those 3 years, the EU, as coordinator of the deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, failed to stand up to Trump. Representatives from Iran, Russia, China, France, Britain, Germany, and the European Commission are attempting to preserve the accord during negotiations in the Austrian capital. US officials are there on the sidelines of the talks. Given that the nuclear deal is underpinned by UN Resolution 2231, the vast majority of diplomats agree it should be respected.
We are 193 member states of the United Nations. Of course, the United States, as you've rightly pointed out, is a powerful member state, but they are a member state. And so we need to rally the numbers against those that may have different opinions.
Some citizens we've been talking to say Tel Aviv is behind efforts to derail the nuclear agreement.
Israel have interest, and Israel are kind of pushing America.
Frankly, what we need is more peace and not more warmongering.
Tehran insists the only way the issue can be resolved is if Washington lifts all of its illegal sanctions. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program.
Ramadan is here. Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care. Cause Ramadan is here. Whoa, Ramadan is here.
Today's lesson. Some special distinctions of the holy month of Ramadan.
Allah.
regarding special distinctions of the holy month of Ramadan and spread of Allah's blessing during this month. A lot of important points have been mentioned in narrations. The points which could be useful and constructive for those who possess an enlightened heart and sense of understanding. According to the traditions, number one, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala pardons 70 million people who are being punished in the hell at the time of fast breaking or iftar during each night of the holy month of Ramadan, and at the end of the holy month forgives an additional number of sinners equivalent to the total sum of those pardoned during the entire month. Now you do the math. Number two, on the first night of the holy month of Ramadan, Allah pardons whoever He pleases. And during each night, He pardons twice the number pardoned in the previous night. And on the last night, Allah forgives twice the number of sinners pardoned during the entire month. Again, you do the math and see how this holy and blessed month is a mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah is making it happen for us. We have to realize the blessings of this month. Every year we run into this month and we exit this blessed month. But do we realize what this holy and blessed month entails? How the doors of mercy of Allah are open, wide open for all of us to walk through? This is something for all the believers, a reminder. And before anyone, it's a reminder for myself.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are talking about some special distinctions of the holy month of Ramadan. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is merciful. We all know that. This is part of our belief system. But this blessed and special month of Ramadan, it brings us some more glad tidings. Allah is merciful, but in this month, He is way more merciful. He has opened up all those doors of mercy for His true servants. We talked about two of the special distinctions of Holy Month before the break. Let's talk about the third one. Well, the most important and explicit tradition about this month is Prophet's astonishment for someone who did nothing for his own forgiveness while the entire Holy Month passed away. The Holy Prophet has said, "May Allah never forgive someone who spent the entire Holy Month without being able to receive forgiveness." Brothers and sisters, this is that opportunity that we were looking for. We don't know whether we're going to see another blessed month of Ramadan in our lifetime or not. Make the most benefit of this blessed month from today onwards. The last but not the least is such special distinction from the beginning till the end of month have not been mentioned for any other month. In other months, only the last one-third nights possess special blessing and special merits, except for Friday nights. All of them possess merits, as well as the holy month of Rajab, all of those whose nights possess such merits. But the month of Ramadan, the holy month of Ramadan, no other month is comparable to it when it comes to Allah pardoning us and opening up the door of His mercy for all of us.
Forgive me for everything I've done in the past, when everything was going so fast, and now I just can't go on.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you are by my side, oh.